Hey, good to have you. It's Chambers Changes and Conversations, the official podcast of Manatee County Government and the show that takes you inside the services, successes, stories, and relationships shaping our region. I'm Communications Division Manager Casey Zempel, joined by Stephanie Garrison. She is our Director of Government Relations, and today's guest has spent years shaping policy and growth right here in Manatee County, from serving as chairman on the Planning Commission to advising on the Affordable Housing Advisory Committee, his work as a senior project manager and vice president at Kim Lee Horn, and now representing our community in Tallahassee, he brings an engineer's practical perspective on how local government and state government can work together to improve your life. Please welcome Florida House District 72 Representative Bill Connerly to Chambers Changes and Conversations. Congratulations.
Thank you. Welcome to
the show.
Thank you for having me.
So, Representative, let's start with kind of a big picture question for those who might be unaware. Can you describe the boundary lines of Florida's House District 72 and specifically the communities you serve?
Yeah, absolutely. It's north to the Hillsborough line, south to Sarasota, east to DeSoto County, and then it kind of runs at an angle across the county as it goes down. It includes portions of Parrish, Myakka City, Lakewood Ranch. When you get over to the coast, some of the areas near the airport. So it's a very large area, but there are no incorporated municipalities in it, all unincorporated Manatee County.
Yeah, and what is, I guess, in addition to that, unique, and how does that kind of shape your priorities in Tallahassee?
Realizing what the district's like includes Myakka City, it includes Lakewood Ranch, very, very different demographics, different interests. So there's concerns related to agriculture. Then there's the urban concerns further west. It's very, very different across the district. And you have to be mindful of that when you're looking at the different issues.
How do you find that balance? Like, I mean, you said it. It's two kind of, not competing demographics, but two very different groups of people.
Yeah, it's not just unique to Manatee County. Mm-hmm. At the state level, you have to find something that works in Miami, it works in Orlando, works in Jacksonville, but it also has to work in DeSoto County, Hardy County, the counties east of us, and the Panhandle. The population in the Panhandle is very sparse. There are representatives that they represent, I think, 5-6 counties, and it's impossible to knock doors in an area like that. They're so far apart. So as a representative, it's approximately 180,000. I think the number is 183,000 people that you represent in a district. But you also have to be mindful you represent the entire state of Florida. So every vote you make, it has an impact on all of the residents of the state.
That's so cool. And thank you so much for being here. You're our first delegation member, first state official in our podcast. So we're honored to have you. It means a lot. Now, before being a representative, you spent over a decade in Manatee County here on the Planning Commission. You were the chair. And often just at the front lines of decisions about growth and land use. Looking back, what's one decision that you're really proud of and maybe one that maybe still keeps you up at night?
That's a hard question. I haven't really thought of it in those terms. One, I'll tell you what my goal was when I served on the Planning Commission. You know, I'm a resident of Manatee County. I'm a taxpayer. So every application that came before the commission, the job that the Planning Commission serves is to vet it, to make sure that it's appropriate when it does go to the board for approval, that questions have been answered, testimony has been given. So every application, you know, is different. There are different issues. We had applications that came in for something as simple as splitting a lot that was not compliant. For example, if it's a, you know, A5, you know, where you need 5 acres to be compliant with the zoning, but maybe a parent would like to give a child a piece of the property, so it wasn't quite there, so that you'd have something like that where you'd split it. It makes sense. It doesn't meet the letter of the rule, but it seems appropriate. Those are very easy. But there were some that came in that had to be vetted. And what I always tried to do was make sure that our discussions solicited testimony that supported the application. So should it ever be challenged, it was very clear of the process that there wasn't opportunity for interpretation or that it was unclear why something happened. Again, I'm a taxpayer. I didn't want my public dollars going to support a lawsuit or some action if ever challenged. So as far as I know, the majority of the applications that we had, I don't know that any were challenged or overturned. So there may have been some that were, but I don't, you know, that process takes so long, so I don't recall anything.
Yeah. How do you think that kind of that due diligence on the front end of things help prepare you for your current role in the legislature?
The process is a like a fact-finding mission where you ask questions. At times on the Planning Commission, I would ask questions I knew the answer to, or I thought I knew the answer to, but it was to solicit information to support the application or to provide better information and inform the commission, or even to help educate the public. The legislative process, again, it's very similar where somebody brings an idea. I think one of the things that's different at the state level is that it's not as easy to identify who's going to take a contrary position. You find out very quickly if there's somebody that has an opinion that's different from something being presented, and you have to educate yourself, inform yourself. As a civil engineer, I'm very technical. Those are the things I know. Social issues are not really, you know, in my wheelhouse. I have to educate myself. The same is true with legal issues, and in some cases, education or healthcare. I know site stuff, facility, you know, things you can actually go out and touch. It's the policies that are more intentional with regard to establishing how something may operate, or, you know, payments related to healthcare. One of the, and this is probably important for every constituent to understand, the majority of the state's budget goes to healthcare and education, like 80% of the budget. So as a civil engineer, I would like to think there's a significant allocation to infrastructure. That's not the case. It's, you know, it's part of that 20% that remains, which is spread out over a lot of different things. So that I think is important for context to understand.
That is really interesting. And I believe, Casey, we have some open Planning Commission seats right now.
We do. Yeah. We actually just posted for them. So
yeah. What would you advise someone who's maybe thinking about applying, or why they should join?
What I would advise is if you have a skill set or an opinion that you feel would be helpful. And I think it helps coming in with an open mind. If you bring like a soapbox to something, it's probably your input's probably going to be very narrow. But if you come in with a attitude that you can, you know, hear information, hear testimony, it is a quasi-judicial process. So technically you're serving as a judge hearing evidence. If the evidence supports it, you know, you have to vote in favor of it. Otherwise, you're violating the process. So I think if you come in with an open mind and a desire to serve your community, those are probably the two most important things.
So in addition to the Planning Commission, you were also on the Affordable Housing Advisory Committee, and you tackled one of the most pressing issues facing Manatee County. What's the single most maybe under-discussed barrier keeping housing out of reach for families in your experience, and what solutions give you hope?
As a amateur politician, I've come up with the three priorities. You know, every politician has their priorities. So what I like to say is that my priorities are water policy. That includes flood resiliency, flood mitigation, also sourcing of water, infrastructure. And when I say infrastructure, everybody thinks roadways, but it's roadways, water distribution, sanitary sewer collection, but also power. Energy is an important infrastructure that we need to be mindful of. And the third thing I say is housing affordability. I don't say affordable housing. It's housing affordability. And of those three priorities, I think the housing affordability is the more difficult solution. The reality is that when you do an affordable housing project or housing that, let's say, the average citizen can access, you know, that it's within their price range, your materials are the same. You know, concrete costs the same, shingles cost the same, asphalt's the same, labor's the same. You can't underpay somebody. So there's not a lot of variation in the cost of the supply or the labor market. So one of the things you can do is you can put more units on the land. The land is another asset that it's affordable projects are competing with market rate projects. So you have to find sources of land. And one of the ways to have a benefit is to put more units on it, density, increase the density. So you're spreading more of the cost of the land over a larger number of units. So I think that's one of the things government can assist with. The other thing are fees and the costs associated. You know, as a local government, we do have programs that allow for waiving of fees or in some cases, the county contributes dollars towards those fees, but it's very limited what can be done. I'm a fiscal conservative. I don't like the idea of public dollars going to it. I know we have dedicated dollars for the 30% of the annual mean income, 30 to 80%, that range. What a lot of people don't realize is every metropolitan study area has a dollar associated as an annual mean income. In the Northport, Bradenton, Sarasota MSA, the metropolitan study area, the AMI, the annual mean income, is over $100,000. So you can think that every police officer, every teacher, every nurse is probably below the 100% AMI if they're early or starting in their career. So trying to understand that, you know, in the context that if you're below the 100%, you're probably qualifying for some type of housing program. That's a significant number of folks in our area. Yeah. And, you know, go to a different county and the AMI might be, say, $40,000. So it varies by county. We're lucky to have a very high-performing, you know, desirable community that, you know, a lot of people want to come here. A lot of the jobs are, you know, well-paid, so we benefit from that. But, you know, we don't want to end up with a migration of young folks leaving just to find jobs or shortages of staffing. I know as county employees, you probably struggle with that, trying to find people to come in.
Absolutely.
There's so many people necessary for, like, the operation of the county that, you know, it's hard to get a significant investment from staffing resources to commit to live in a place. If you can't find a place to live close by, you're probably going to be maybe Hardy County, DeSoto County, you know, and then what are you doing? You're putting trips on the road. So the staffing shortfalls are actually contributing to the congestion in the road. Just, I mean, that's, if we could find ways to get the staff, the potential staff, closer to the employment centers, that would be beneficial. So,
yeah. So you mentioned infrastructure in particular as one of your main areas, and we know that infrastructure is something that we're paying a lot of attention to right now. From an engineer's perspective, what's one area where you think the state and county must get ahead of the curve to avoid major problems later?
The reality is that, you know, there are more mature communities than Sarasota Manatee area. I always group Sarasota Manatee together because if you build a road in Sarasota County, it benefits Manatee. If you build a road in Manatee, it benefits Sarasota County. It's a network, and they're hard to divide. So many people transit back and forth daily between the two municipalities. But you can look at more mature areas and, you know, like, for example, down in South Florida, you drive through and they're always working on roads. So you're never going to have your infrastructure sufficient for a community that is growing at a reasonable rate. It's always going to be behind, and then there's going to be maintenance, and then there's going to be probably new technologies that come in that have to be implemented. So these are things that are going to be a constant input to, honestly, it contributes to the difficulty of the transportation, to the travel times. Right now in Sarasota County, they're beginning to work on Fruitvale. And guess what? Fruitvale backs up every morning and every afternoon. So it's a known issue that the building of the thing that is going to be the benefit in the future always causes issues.
And, you know, getting ahead of that, you know, because you've mentioned it's one of your three. Where are you kind of paying attention to in infrastructure? You mentioned energy, I know, is another big one.
Right. Just a couple things. Of course, the infrastructure that everybody, the deficient infrastructure that everybody gets to experience daily is our roadways. Yeah. So you notice it. If your water works fine and your sewer works fine, that doesn't make the paper. Nobody notices that. For example, the city of Bradenton just recently had an issue with their wastewater treatment facility where they had to discharge. That's very problematic, and that is an issue related to infrastructure. They have 60 miles of gravity main that is very poor, so when it rains, at times the inflow into that plant triples. So part of what the city of Bradenton is trying to do is, you know, funding from the state to slip line the gravity sewer. It takes time to do that, and it just it gets highlighted at certain times that it is problematic. With regard to energy, I feel that the state is going to be very dependent on energy in the future for some of the things that are going to provide quality of life and be very important for our economic infrastructure for businesses. There's a lot of discussion right now on AI. So AI is very, very dependent on data centers. Data centers are kind of the interface between the different systems. Data centers have two things that are in high demand when these are in place: water for cooling and power for operation. Florida, we do not have sufficient power to keep up with the exponential increase in the need for data centers to support AI.
Is that why we're seeing them more set up more in like rural areas of the United States?
Right. Right now, Virginia is probably the nexus of data centers, and they've been more accommodating to those. So the ability right now to add large demands like a data center, we don't have that ability. So I think we need, over the next 10, 15 years, we need to put Florida in a position where we can start investing in infrastructure, power generation, distribution, and transmission. A lot of our efforts right now related to power or energy are for storm hardening. We see those projects all over the place, very important. And then storm restoration. Those are the two things a lot of the effort and dollars go toward. The other things that are going to potentially be large demanders of energy in the future, like, for example, water. The sourcing of our potable water is right now typically groundwater or surficial water where it's treated. You know, we have in Manatee County, we have Lake Manatee. Manatee County is also part of the Peace River Water Authority, with a couple other counties, and they take surficial water, treat it and distribute it, or groundwater, pull groundwater up and treat it and use it. So this is having an impact on the aquifer, and Florida is a peninsula, and when you remove water from the aquifer, and we have the Gulf on one side and the Atlantic on the other, you get a hydraulic gradient. It's like pressure. It's water runs downhill. Just think of that as a hill. It's the elevation of the water at the sea level and the groundwater. So you get a gradient and water comes in. So your aquifer gets more saline. And that's where they kind of restrict groundwater withdrawals when you're adjacent to the coast. The difficulty is once you get saltwater intrusion, you can't push it back. You can't push back the Atlantic Ocean. The reality is that we have water on both sides, but it's saline. So what is the solution? It's going to be desalinization. Guess what? Desalinization is a significant user of power.
Right. Mm.
So that's something that, again, we need to put ourselves in a position where we can actually provide the what the public is going to demand, yes. The potable water. And then again, agriculture, we're going to need
a
to continue.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you're saying right now, most of our resources, most of our efforts, it's happening on just keeping up with storm recovery, storm resiliency, agriculture. We're not necessarily positioned right now, is what I'm hearing you saying, for this like new data consumption that AI is exponentially increasing?
That's my opinion. And the other thing is that and all those things are very, very important. The reality is it's money, you know, the investment. And one of the things, like, for example, there's been a bit of a nuclear energy renaissance. And, you know, with one of the plants that they were scheduled to start decommissioning, they're actually going to extend the licensing in the agreement.
Let's talk. I know you are very interested in nuclear. I don't know a ton about nuclear, but and probably the general public doesn't know much either. What should people know about nuclear energy? Because a lot of folks might say, "Oh, radiation. I don't want the contamination." Right. What would you say to that?
I think it's been proven that nuclear power is safer. Like, for example, if you do cold fire, you know, CO2 emissions, and you know that has a negative impact. It tends to have issues related to, you know, breathing, and it has an impact on the atmosphere and in the area where the plants are. Gas fired's a more efficient, more effective way, but nuclear, typically the facilities, you can build a facility and it could operate for 50, 60, 70, 80 years. So it has a longer lifespan. There are technologies. You have to realize that nuclear technology has advanced over a very, very long period of time, since World War II, when they, first it was weaponized, and then a lot of smart people realized that this could be a source of power. So the technology, as it advances, it gets safer and safer. Right now, we have some reactors that are, you know, second generation or, you know, third generation. They tend to be pressurized water reactors. Those are more subject to having issues than some of the other technology that's being developed. For example, like Three Mile Island, that was a issue related to cooling. So when they talked about Three Mile Island, it wasn't a nuclear explosion. It was an explosion from the water pressure, the steam exploding, that
the water evaporated,
that it breached, mm-hmm. and allowed some radiation. I've gone down a couple rabbit holes listening to podcasts. Some reports say that it was similar to like a chest X-ray, and others that, you know, it was worse. So there's some debate, but I don't know that there's any direct contribution of known deaths related to that issue. I think a lot of people would say exposure to radiation might have had issues, but some of the newer technologies, they use a different moderator. They'll use like a liquid salt, or they'll use sodium, and those can operate at one atmosphere, so they're not pressurized, and they have passive safeties in them, almost like a freeze plug. So if it does get out of control and overheats, it'll simply just dump the material on the ground. And to be absolutely clear, that's radioactive material, but it's contained in a vessel. So the issue with, or concerns with a lot of the second generation reactors is the explosion from the water vapor that would then breach the containment vessels, and then it goes out. So the technology is advancing. It's just not scaled, nor has it been adopted and licensed by the Nuclear mm-hmm. Regulatory Commission. So it's going to take a little bit of time. One of the trends we're seeing are SMRs, the small modular reactors. Those are things that are using like the Gen 4 technology in the different moderators, but they're new, and it takes about 10 years before those get into production. I think we're getting close. I believe there's a facility, actually a data center, that's being commissioned. I think it's in Idaho.
Okay.
Might be Nevada.
It's being powered nuclearly?
It's in the process of being commissioned, the license.
That's cool.
So how does this kind of feed into some of your work coming up in this next session?
Well, at the state level, I think what we need to do is to put the state in a position where if something federally happens, then we can take advantage of it. For example, make sure that the process is at the state level, doesn't throw up additional hurdles. To be very clear, my approach with regard to energy is all of the above. I think we should do the natural gas.
Yeah.
Or, nuclear. Those are the two obvious. A lot of people say solar, and we have no wind in the state of Florida, so that's not really a viable investment, I think, that would be made now. When you talk about solar and wind to some degree, you're actually not doing energy production, you're doing energy harvesting, you're pulling it. In many cases, like with solar, you have storage issues. When it's sunny, you may not need it. At night, you might need it. So batteries are becoming more of a kind of an ancillary component of that. So you have more consistent energy. In Florida, we do actually have quite a few solar arrays. You can drive on I-10 or drive out 62.
Yeah.
And you can see them.
By Duet, we've got a huge solar battery up there, right?
Mm-hmm.
So.
And so what committee assignments do you have coming up in this next 26th session? Has it been decided yet?
Yes, and they're the same committees I had last session. Just a few of them. I'm on the Select Committee for Property Taxes, and I'm sure we can talk about that a little bit later. I'm on the Transportation Economic Development. I'm on Natural Resources and Disasters, Economic Infrastructure. So all technical committees.
Yeah.
I'm on no legal, healthcare, or education committees. So I'm happy about that.
Yeah, so we do want to talk about it briefly. Senate Bill 180, that bill, and it touches on a couple things that we've talked about, maybe briefly. That bill contains what many have said are several beneficial provisions, like post-storm permitting reforms, but also contains some concerns that you voice yourself, especially around the vague term burdensome in Section 18. That section restricts local governments from enacting certain regulations within a year after a hurricane makes landfall and has some potential impact on flood resiliency and things like that. Now, if the legislature were to revisit SB 180, maybe in a future session, what amendments would you potentially push for and address some of the concerns while keeping those positive elements intact?
Yeah, just before we get started on what would change, I would like to emphasize that Senate Bill 180, the title of it it's emergencies.
Yeah.
So one of the intents of the bill was to keep the fiscal economy, the fiscal structure in an area that had been impacted secure. So there wouldn't be opportunities where price would increase or process would increase and cost, something like that. So that was the intent of it. I think it would be appropriate to better define burdensome and just do a little bit deeper dive into the elements associated with that. And I think that's most appropriate. Some of the representation is that it's banning, it's delaying. So I think that's clear. The timelines in there, a lot of people say, oh, we're in Florida. Every year we're going to get a storm. There's going to be another executive order, knock wood. So far this year, yeah, it's been relatively calm. And,
thankfully.
Yeah. So after last year, that's a welcome change. I think that's, you know, if we make it through, we're going to be very lucky this year without having any major storms hit the state. But there are some, I think, some tweaks. And I think probably the most appropriate would be related to defining the definitions used to kind of restrict those things.
And that's something that you addressed in the first 5 minutes in being very clear on that, you know, the front end of things. So there's not too much room for interpretation later on.
Yeah, one of the very stark educations and being a newly elected representative is there's always unintended consequences of bills. And I've learned, you know, in my vast experience of one session, actually we had four sessions, but three special sessions and the extended regular session, that you don't need to talk to the cheerleaders. You need to talk to the people who take a contrary position on your bill to understand what their concerns are. The cheerleaders, it's the same thing. You hear that rather frequently. It's the soliciting the contrary opinions so you can collect the information and you can make an informed decision.
That sounds wise. You know, some local governments, including Manatee County, they've raised strong objections and, you know, for us, even filed legal challenges to Senate Bill 180. How do you balance your role, you know, representing state interests in Tallahassee with also ensuring your home county has the flexibility that it needs to protect residents?
Right. The it's a difficult position because the county has to rely on the state for funding and legislative issues. And when I say the state, you know, we're talking, you know, three bodies of government. So, you know, the legislative body of government, the House and the Senate, they don't always agree. And then the executive body, the governor, he doesn't always agree with the House and the Senate. I don't know if a lot of the listeners understand, but it was pretty interesting this past year. There was a lot of friction between the House and the governor. And to get anything through, everybody has to agree. So if you are more willing to partner and, again, have wise, thoughtful discussions, you're in a better position. If you take a position that's contrary and then ask them to do something for you, it's going to be very difficult. So one of my concerns with the municipalities that have entered into the lawsuit, which Manatee County is one of them, is there might be a fiscal impact on money coming back that benefits all the residents of the county. I had two appropriations that I thought were excellent appropriations that were vetoed, and I felt like that might have been a little bit of a sign from the governor, you know, mind your P's and Q's. It's, you know, this is potentially impactful. A lot of times people say, oh, you know, it's $1 million here, $1 million there. Actually, the residents of Manatee County and the businesses of Manatee County, last year they had around $351 million that benefited the different things that were asked for. This included like $17 million for C grants and $80 million for SCF, you know, the new campus. So it wasn't dollars directly to the county, but it was for the residents. So, you know, there's an opportunity, again, to have a negative impact on the residents of the county. And that's what I'm trying to avoid. One of my desires when I ran for office was to be able to direct money back to Manatee County for infrastructure, for things like parks and, you know, things that add quality of life for our residents. And I think those are very important. So to do anything appropriate, correct, to get something done is very difficult.
Yeah.
It's a very good example is there were probably, I think, just under 2,000 bills filed this past session, and a little over 200, I think it was like 220, made it through. So that gives you a
10%.
Yeah. So it's not easy. You can't just say, I'm going to file a bill and do this, because you have to get through three or four committees. So you're lobbying your committee chairs just to get your bill heard. And it has to be passed through all the committees to even be considered to be heard on the floor. In addition, you have to have a companion bill in the Senate to get that through. So if the Senate has no interest in doing it, your efforts are done for no reason. There's no gain.
That's right. And we want to thank you, because we want to recognize that effort of getting those two appropriations from Manatee County through not just the committees, not just the House, but also through the Senate. And that was and submitted to the governor. So that is no small feat. Yeah. And we definitely appreciate your advocacy.
Yeah, I was able to get a couple others that in a roundabout way, they benefit the Manatee mm-hmm. County folks. And Paragon mm-hmm. was one of the yeah. it's a software used for hurricane tracking. And so I had a very good session. I actually had five bills that made it all the way through the process. And again, I had appropriations that made it through. So I had a successful session, but I want to do more. I feel like I'm just getting started, and just getting that exposure helps me understand the process. And I want to be able to continue the work. I've got a lot of ideas related to things that are going to take probably, if I'm there, if I'm lucky enough to do four sessions, I think the work is going to continue even after I'm gone. But I think it's very important to the state.
Yeah. And I just want to thank you for having the conversation. We know it's sensitive. We know it's delicate. And being able to hear another side of it, another perspective, is important. I think the citizens appreciate it. And I'm just curious, that bills like Senate Bill 180, do these highlight a larger issue in Florida of state preemption versus local home rule? And what are your thoughts on that? Is that something, what would you want citizens to know about?
Well, the first thing is that all of the authority for all local municipalities comes from the state. So if the state feels that something is not being done appropriately, they're going to step in. So I think partnership, communication from the local level to the state level is very, very important. So the reality is that many times things are done to correct actions of a bad actor. And I think there's a common local narrative that Senate Bill 180 was directed at Manatee County. I don't know that that's true. I know Pinellas had issues. It seemed like areas along the coast on both sides, and then Orlando in the center, seem to be the ones that are taking exception. I guess you could probably look at the list of counties and cities that filed on the lawsuit, and those are probably the counties that think that that bill was directed at them. And I don't know that it was one county. I think it was maybe just some activity somewhere. The reality is that this wasn't the two amendments. It wasn't a lot of discussion related to that in committee. That didn't come up. It was added in, and it wasn't a lot of dialogue. Like I said, communication, where you need to hear from the people that have the contrary opinions. We didn't get that on this bill. So I think it ended up being a surprise. But to be very honest, though, I don't know that there was a lot of time. It was an amendment in the chamber, so that could be part of the reason for this particular bill.
Representative, one of the things I know you're passionate about that we've talked about is mm-hmm. flood resiliency. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit more about what's going on in that area.
Yes, as a civil engineer, I have a lot of experience with this. For 28 years, I've done stormwater modeling, and I understand I think what is probably a presumption of a lot of people, but as an experienced licensed engineer, I know that it is an issue. There's an opinion that maybe rainfall, the storms are becoming more intense. And the reality is there's actually a natural cycle of hurricanes. It's like 40 to 60 years where intensification, I think during the 40s, like around World War II, it was pretty intense, but there were a lot fewer people in the state to actually witness that. In the 60s again, but the reality, there are natural cycles. For example, recently on the news, we've heard a lot about Saharan dust being blown across Africa. And what that means is you have a particulate in suspension in the clouds that water can condense on. And, you know, depending on where it is, it kind of intensifies the rainfall. You also have things like El Nino. Again, those are cyclical. And then there's something called the multi-decadal Atlantic occurrence. That's where the temperature of the Atlantic will increase or decrease about a degree. And that's enough to actually have an impact on the hurricane formation and intensification. So the current 100-year storm, and a 100-year storm is what the insurance industry, what the government, FEMA, what the counties have all in the state have all decided is an appropriate design storm. So that's the level of risk or the cost associated with designing that is acceptable. So in Southwest Florida Water Management District, a 100-year storm is 10 inches in 24 hours. So the recent events that we had, you know, we had Hurricane Helene, Hurricane Milton, and Tropical Storm Debbie. It became a hurricane elsewhere, but in our area, it was a tropical storm. Of those storms, in my district, Debbie was more impactful because it was a rain event. So the volume of rain in basins, a lot of times you'll hear, oh, it rained 18 inches. And that's usually traveling across and it's in different basins. But what I'm talking about is a rainfall in a very specific basin for 24 hours, the intensification. So the water management district uses something called IDF curves. That's intensity, duration, and frequency. So the 100-year storm that we use currently, it's 10 inches in 24 hours. If you go on, say, Atlas 14, you click in an area, and I did an investigation of the River Club area. You look at the rain event for Debbie, not for Debbie, but that area, it was about 12.8, I think is what it was. So essentially it's about 28% over your design storm. So when you have a design that fails a little bit, it's catastrophic. So, you know, there was flooding in the River Club area, and there were two factors. One of the factors was related to the volume of rain. The other was related to some maintenance. There was some sedimentation, I think, on the other side of the interstate, on the it was either Braden River or one of the tributaries that fed up into the River Club. So it caused it to the flooding to be more intense. But what I think the engineering it seems like all engineers have come to the conclusion that we might be underestimating what a 100-year storm is. So when you use Atlas 14, you're underestimating compared to now like 28%. So what Atlas 14 is it's a running database of every storm event. Plus there's modeling to kind of, you know, continue the curve if it's, you know, smaller events. So it's essentially a new way to identify the IDF, the intensity, duration, and frequency. So for a 100-year storm in certain areas, if you look at what you're using versus what the Atlas 14 might have, you know, it seems to be problematic. So one of the things I would like to try to find a way to do at the state level is compel the water management districts, the local municipalities to utilize the best available information, which again is probably something like the Atlas 14, and they're working on Atlas 15. And the difference between Atlas 14 and Atlas 15 is that they make a projection for 2070, and it's about a 10% increase over that 50 year that they're presuming that if the cyclical nature continues, it could be additional rainfall. So it would be most appropriate that we use the best available information instead of something that was prepared by data samples that were done manually, you know, in the probably late 70s, early 80s. So it seems more appropriate. The other thing I would like to see is the state to compel the creation of stormwater models for all 29 watersheds. The other thing that we have to understand is that watersheds don't respect county boundaries, city boundaries. They, like, for example, the Peace River watershed goes from Winter Haven all the way to Charlotte Harbor. So what happens in Winter Haven has an impact on every county, every city down the river. So it's the water, you know, it makes sense. Water falls, it runs into the river, it flows through. So when you have a hurricane event, it's not uncommon where the worst flooding is a day later or 2 days later after the storm. And that's because it takes time for the water to run to the conveyance and then move down. A very good example of why these two things, again, using the most modern data and compelling the establishment or creation of every watershed to have a stormwater model, is like Hurricane Ian. When Ian went through, again, that's in the more in the Peace River Basin, the intersection of State Road 70 and 72 flooded. You would think it would be important to understand that two state roads, which serve as evacuation routes for the city of Arcadia and DeSoto County, would flood. That it prepares you. So it's not going to fix anything that's already low, but what it will do is it'll provide us information. It'll inform us on areas that are going to be problematic, so we can then address them. It's also going to, if you use this for design of, for example, buildings or stormwater facilities, it's gonna have higher finished floors, higher road elevation. So flooding is a volume problem. If you can construct a stormwater facility that can hold the volume and meter it out at a slower rate, it's gonna be better condition for the neighborhood, the community, whatever it is. If you undersize it and it goes over, it's always catastrophic. So that's
thank you for that. Yeah, that's a really just specific and practical answer of why it happens and what are some of the key focus points we can do to research and learn more to be better informed.
Yeah, and provide clarity. And like you said, an ability to look ahead and you know, kind of look at these areas that might be susceptible to larger, you know.
Yeah, and the reality is, this is Florida. You know, my family's been here forever.
Sure.
We've had flooding forever, and we're going to continue to have issues. We just need to be mindful and provide solutions that are specific to those issues, that provide volume storage. My grandmother, she was 28 hurricane. She was in Miami when that went through, and she said that they got no warning. She said some kids came in from a dance, and a group of sailors came by and said, "Hey, a storm's coming."
And that was it.
That was it.
And then devastation.
Wow. Yeah.
So it's we have advanced significantly, but I think there's still more work we can do to provide, again, better quality of life for our residents in the state and Southwest Florida, Manatee County.
And that sound means we have reached our lightning round, Representative. We need fast answers to the following quick questions. Are you ready, sir?
I am.
Florida House District 72 Representative Bill Connerly. Lightning round. Chambers Changes Conversations. Here we go. One word that describes your vision for District 72.
I think it's very important that we're forward-looking. We have to maintain the quality of life for our residents.
That's good.
Perfect. Favorite project you've been a part of in Manatee County?
Right now, I'm working on 572 affordable housing projects, 30 to 80% AMI just south of DeSoto Square. I can't wait to see that at the grand opening.
If you could solve one challenge overnight, what would it be?
Traffic.
You're not the only one that's come up with that answer. A law or policy that you're most proud of influencing?
Right now, it's probably the Springs Restoration Bill I ran that takes 35 million gallons a day and puts it back into the aquifer that feed the Itchinatucky and Santa Fe Springs.
Favorite way to spend a weekend in District 72?
Boating.
Local place in Manatee County you believe deserves a little bit more attention?
First Watch.
There you go. Can't go wrong with First Watch.
One of the most surprising things that you've learned since being elected to office?
How many issues come up that are presented by just average citizen. It's amazing how many people bring issues and they're dedicating their time and they're passionate about it. It's a parade of people that have good intentions.
That's great. And if you could describe Manatee County's future in one phrase, what would it be?
Better traffic.
Lofty goals, yeah. but achievable ones.
Yes. And
yeah. Thank you, Representative Connerly, for sharing your story, your vision with us, from all your years on the Planning Commission, the Affordable Housing Advisory Committee, your work now in Tallahassee. You really continue to make sure that Manatee County's voice is heard on the state level. So we really appreciate that. And if somebody wants to get in touch with you, how do they go about doing that?
Just go to the House of Representatives website, pull down Representatives. It has my name on there. Just click that. It has, if you look through the information, it'll have contact your House member. And there's also in the notes, there's telephone numbers and email addresses for my aides who schedule meetings. I have a virtual office. I don't have a physical office, but what that allows me to do, if you call and say, hey, I want to have a WebEx meeting, we'll schedule it. If you say, I want to meet you, I'll come to wherever it's convenient for you. Right now we're meeting in areas like the library or Lakewood Ranch Town Hall. They have some areas that we've been allowed to use. So I'm trying to be flexible as best I can.
Well, we certainly thank you for that. And thank you for listening to another episode of Chambers Changes and Conversations. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcast so you don't miss out on the stories, the conversation shaping our community. And don't forget to like and comment. It really does go a long way to get the word out to your neighbors. On behalf of the men and women doing work that matters behind the scenes for you, I'm Casey Zempel.
I'm Stephanie Garrison.
I'm Bill Connerly.
Make it a great day to live, work, and play in
Manatee County.
The opinions expressed by guests of Chambers Changes and Conversations do not necessarily reflect those of Manatee County government or its employees.